Okay, good afternoon. Today I'm pleased to announce that Hekia Parata is to be appointed a Minister in Cabinet. Hekia takes over the Ethnic Affairs and Women's Affairs portfolios previously held by Pansy Wong. She will also be Associate Minister for ACC, of Energy and Resources, and for the Community and Voluntary Sector. Hekia brings to the job a strong background in the public service, and she's also been a very successful businesswoman. She achieved an excellent result for the National Party in the Mana by-election after running an outstanding campaign. I look forward to welcoming Hekia to the Executive. She's competent and able and will be sworn in on Wednesday afternoon. I'd also like to take this opportunity to announce the new CDF. The government is appointing Major General Rhys Jones as the Chief of Defence Force for a period of 3 years. The position became available when Lieutenant General Jerry Matapararo retires from military service. Major General Jones is currently Chief of Army and has the strategic leadership, intellectual capacity, management experience and personal qualities the new position requires. Prior to being Chief of Army, Major General Jones was Commander of the Joint Forces New Zealand. This appointment will take effect in the early part of next year. At that time, Major General Jones will then take the rank of Lieutenant General. Today I introduce the New Zealand SIS Amendment Bill, which will update the New Zealand Security Intelligence Service Act 1969. The original legislation is over 40 years old and modernising it is long overdue. The bill updates the warrants framework, paying particular attention to electronic tracking devices, computer surveillance and technology like mobile phones and cyber identities. In practice, this doesn't change the threshold to obtain a warrant. The New Zealand SIS currently issues approximately between 11 and 15 domestic warrants each year, and I don't expect that number to alter because of the change in legislation. What the amendments do, though, is bring the legal and technological framework around the New Zealand SIS up to date. From a legal perspective, this is driven by the fact that developments in case law mean that there is an expectation for any search and seizure by state agencies to be supported by express provisions in legislation rather than general provisions. I'd like to point out that these amendments are about modernising the powers of the SIS and taking into account the technological advances and legal changes that have been made in the past 4 decades. The ability to undertake certain activities, like electronic tracking, is already specifically provided for in legislation covering agencies like the police and customs. It makes sense to bring the SIS into line with that and to take into account the technological changes which have been made in the past four decades. At the same time, it's important that we strike the right balance between New Zealand's privacy and the security of the country. The bill will have its first reading on Thursday. It's my intention to propose that the Intelligence and Security Committee seek public submissions after the bill has been referred to the committee. This week I'm in Wellington and in the House Tuesday and Wednesday. On Tuesday afternoon I'm speaking at the OECD Inside Innovation Forum, and on Thursday I'm in Auckland for a number of engagements. On Friday I'll be launching the new Kiwi Rail locomotives in Hamilton, and on Sunday I'll attend a special children's Christmas party in Auckland. This week will be a busy one in the House. Tomorrow the bill establishing a referendum on MMP at the 2011 election will be read a second time, along with the bill containing the government's electoral finance changes. Those bills will be passed by the end of the year. Wednesday is Members' Day. On Thursday the House will move into urgency to send a series of bills to Select Committee before the end of the year and pass a number of bills that have been reported back from committee and require enactment for a range of reasons.
Why are the changes to the SIS
Act? Yeah, SIS Act, yeah. I guess you could say it's not really urgently because it's taken 40 years to update the legislation, but essentially what's come out of the case law from the Bill of Rights has been that rather than having general provisions for the issuing of warrants and surveillance activity, we need specific provisions, and that's really the main thing. It's also reflecting that modern-day technology and electronics have evolved, and we need legislation that addresses that.
But the SIS itself rejected a 2 to 3 year fundamental review, saying they were urgent. Was that for the Rugby World Cup?
Well, Rugby World Cup is one factor that we think makes this necessary, but we think it's been overdue for quite some time.
What about...
Why does the Rugby World Cup make it so
Oh, just that is a factor when you're hosting the third largest sporting event in the world. Obviously, we need to make sure that we provide all of the national security that is appropriate for such an event. We're not doing this because we're predicting an unstable environment then, but nevertheless the facts of life are when you're hosting such a major sporting event with a lot of potentially world leaders being here, it's important that we have the right legislation.
So there will be higher checks and balances because it opens it up to electronic tracking, mobile phones and all, privacy issues.
Well, there's already a very high standard effectively set because for a warrant to be issued, it needs to be signed not only by me but also by the Commissioner of Security Warrants, Sir John Jeffries is at the moment. It's a very thorough process, and you can see by the number of warrants we issue between about 11 to 15 a year, it's not a large number, so we're quite selective in what we do.
So what changes have been made to the delegation of powers, though, to the Director of Security? I understand some changes have been made.
Well, he has some greater powers, as I say, because of the specific provisions in the legislation. So that allows him to do a number of things that he can't do today. But I don't want to detail those.
What's the actual issue around mobile phones and cyber identities that
Well, I don't want to go into the specifics. You'd appreciate that in a practical sense, what the legislation does is make the operation of the New Zealand SIS more effective and efficient when it has a warrant issued, but for reasons of national security, I don't want to detail what those are.
I mean, one of the things that it looks like just on a quick read of the summary that you handed out is that there's a fear that an SIS agent who's effectively hacking into someone's computer could actually breach the Bill of Rights. Is that what's...
I don't want to, for obvious reasons, go into the specifics because clearly there are elements that need addressing and they're getting addressed in the legislation. All I can tell you is in a practical sense it gives there are some holes which are being tightened up, and it certainly allows us to move to specific provisions rather than general ones.
Is this going to the select committee?
It'll go to a select committee, but that will be heard in private.
So the public makes submissions, but they don't get to...
Well, they can make their point to the select committee.
In writing, but not in person?
No, they can come to the select committee.
So will those hearings be open?
No.
Why not make it open? Because, I mean, obviously there are issues with sensitivity, but the law itself is based on principle and relatively practical things, like inclusion of things and rights. Wouldn't it be in the public interest to have that open?
I don't think so, no.
Yeah.
For a whole bunch of reasons that we don't want to go into.
Doesn't that make it look like there are issues with the bill if you're not willing to open it up and at least have it examined and discussed openly, when the bill itself obviously needs to go through Parliament?
Yeah, well, there are some practicalities in terms of the way that they operate, and I don't want to go into those specifics. All I can tell you is that the legislation as it currently stands is not adequate for what is a modern-day setting. We can achieve the outcomes we want as a general rule, but that is not the best practice, as we've seen by the Bill of Rights, and we need to update that.
Don't you think if there are these issues around the Bill of Rights, the public should have as much input as possible into changing this policy?
Well, all I can tell you is the provisions that are in that will be contained in the SIS legislation are essentially the same ones that the police and customs already have in their legislation.
So these submissions, the written submissions, will they be released publicly?
Well, there's no reason why someone can't release their own submission. They're welcome to do that.
Right, but the hearings themselves will be closed.
Correct.
Which committee will it be going
to? Goes to the SIS select committee.
Isn't it for the committee itself to determine whether it's held closely in private, not the government?
Well, that's true, but I chair it.
Does the public submission compromise national security?
Sorry?
How could submissions from members of the public compromise national security all the way that the SIS operates?
Well, it can, because of the engagement and the dialogue and things that we go through. It's a possibility.
So the exchange is as much with the MP?
It's a possible.
I mean, doesn't it seem like a convenient, quite a sort of convenient excuse to blame this on the Rugby World Cup? I mean, if this was such a problem, why hadn't something been done about it earlier?
Well, we're not blaming on the Rugby World Cup. We're saying that this is a modernisation of legislation that's been around for 40 years and that needs modernising when you consider the current day settings and the type of electronic equipment that's used, the type of surveillance that's been undertaken. So Rugby World Cup is a factor, but by no means the only factor.
Do you know if you've got the support of other parties, both for the legislation and for the way that it's been dealt with?
We believe we do. So the Director General has gone and spoken to the Leader of the Opposition, who's indicated that they'll be supporting the legislation.
Has there been any other bills that have gone through Parliament with totally closed
Don't know.
So will we at least be able to know who's appearing before you to give evidence?
Well, there's nothing stopping someone saying they're going before the committee.
Well, yeah, but will the committee actively tell us? Because how do we know that you're not picking and choosing who you hear evidence from?
Well, that's a factor, I guess, for you to consider. But I mean, look, at the end of the day, it's not an open process.
But the public's to have confidence in this. Surely they must at least know whether or not you're hearing both sides of the argument, civil libertarian side, for example.
Well, someone that wants to put in the submission is free to do so. I guess if they're not heard, then they can make that publicly known.
So on that basis, agencies that are connected with government, SIS, GCSB, etc., that may want to submit,
they might make
this, we'll never know.
Oh, we may or may not, depending on whether they want to make that public.
Well,
the SIS won't be making a submission on their own legislation.
Probably wouldn't want them to disclose either, would you?
May or may not.
So the official viewpoint or the official position on this change, we may never be aware of.
Well, you may not see those submissions, no, for obvious reasons.
Are you going to issue a select committee report?
I would imagine so, yes. It can be 5 years. Some of them have been 5 years. This particular incident is going to be 3 years.
Then why was
that? Well, primarily because there's a big job in front of the new CDF, and that is in relation to the value for money exercise that needs to be introduced. That's a big piece of work for the new Chief of Defence Force, and we want to make sure we're in a position to monitor that progress.
Wouldn't that be an argument, though, for a longer tenure if you've got the project?
It may well be that the CDF's, at the end of that 3-year process, it has an extension.
It looks like you're moving towards 3-year terms for many of these senior appointments you make.
Not always, but some of them. We obviously did that with the new police.
You're saying that by putting in a 3-year term, if progress isn't good enough, you can move them on and get someone else to come in and we'll do it quicker.
Well, that would be an option for the government if we weren't satisfied.
Why was Red Stone selected instead of the other candidates?
Yes, so there were four people that were shortlisted. There was a recommendation made by the State Services Commissioner, but there was a panel of independent people who went through a process of interviewing them and all the normal standard processes that they go through. They made a recommendation. Their recommendation was Rhys Jones, and we accepted that recommendation.
Was the recommendation the same as the recommendation from the State Services Commissioner?
Correct, yes. Yeah.
There's been four internal reviews of the policy and some type of work. Would you just order a wide review that involves all of the stakeholders, road users, as well?
What I can say to you is, firstly, we are obviously concerned by the number of New Zealanders that have lost their lives on the road as a result of these pursuits. And on the best advice I have at the moment, that number stands at 18 for 2010. The second thing is that each one of those particular events triggers an independent police complaints authority investigation, and the Minister's made it clear that if recommendations come out of that that inquiry, then she will look to implement those. She is also looking at whether there are other options available to her to send a strong message to people that they shouldn't be running from the police. And she's in the process of considering all of those and may well bring some recommendations to Cabinet at some point.
And maybe they have a discouragement policy, which causes to get any pursuit except in extreme circumstances. Is that something that the government can
mention? Well, that is the current policy. I mean, there is quite a framework that's determined, or procedure that's determined by the police at which point they stop a pursuit. But obviously, the message is a pretty clear one, that if a police officer asks you to pull over, you should do that. We can't have a lawless society where people decide to take the law into their own hands and simply decide they can run from the police with no consequences. But clearly, the balancing act here is to make sure it doesn't unduly put at risk the lives of innocent New Zealanders. Might be an upgrade in the way some people think of David Cunliffe. Look, I don't know. All I can tell you is I had a very quick look at this speech. I mean, frankly, quite how Labor are going to square the circle on that is beyond me. I mean, they're telling New Zealanders that they are not going to spend more, they're going to pay off debt faster, they're going to cut taxes to middle-income New Zealanders, but at the same time, they're going to restore payments into the New Zealand Super Fund. And by the way, they're still going to find $250 million for their GST off fresh fruit and vegetables. So from what I can see, they are minus $2.25 billion before they even start, and apparently they're going to pay off debt faster and not raise taxes. So it's going to be a magical response from the Leader of the Opposition.
Well, on the economy, the Treasury
what do you think of the fact that we can't actually get the finance
spokesperson's
name right?
Well, if you can't get this finance spokesperson's name right, you probably can't get the policies right either. And from what we can see, there is no policy at this point. There's a lot of promises, but they just simply don't add up. So maybe the finance team needs to start with not only a new spokesman, but a calculator as well.
On the economy, the Treasury today is predicting that the economy will grow just 2% next year, but household spending is under real pressure, particularly because of rising food prices, and that next year the GST increase pushing inflation up to 5% will offset the income tax cut so that household spending will still be under real pressure in the middle of next year. That's not, I guess, the aggressive recovery that you've talked about.
Well, first of all, I haven't seen those comments, but what I have seen is a prediction that growth will be in the order of 3.5% next year. So I don't know where the 2% number comes from.
Their latest report out today.
Well, the numbers I've seen are 3.5%, so I might have to wait and see some other data thing reduce. Secondly, in terms of GST increases, they were compensated for in totality for all New Zealanders, either through personal tax cuts or an increase in super or benefits. Food prices always rise. In fact, they've risen by a much smaller amount under National than they did under Labor. They are accommodated for through the general wage increase, which is running at around probably about 1.5% through the economy. So my view is it tough for some New Zealanders? Yes, but a lot of their expenses are lower than they otherwise have been. Petrol prices considerably lower, interest rates considerably lower, general inflation running at 1.5%. And I wouldn't take too much store in the 5% inflation, because as we know, the Reserve Bank Governor is going to look through that, so it won't have any impact on interest rates. And it's accounted for in the increase in payments that we made either through New Zealand Super or tax cuts.
But are you concerned, because they also raise concerns that the export growth that we're getting, the risks of that from the drought, from the PSA outbreak, from the mining disaster, that's going to actually diminish as well over time. So, I mean, looking ahead, they don't seem to be hugely optimistic about next year.
Well, look, I think all of us need to accept that the international environment is fragile. And we've seen that with another bout of concern about what's happening both in Ireland and in Spain. And they are factors that maybe are predictable, but they also are a factor of, a result of a very, very deep global financial crisis. From New Zealand's point of view, no one's arguing it's easy for New Zealanders, but what I can say is we're in a lot better shape than a lot of other countries. If you look at Australia, their growth numbers were out last week. They're much lower than people thought, at 0.2%. If you look at unemployment in the US, went up to 9.8% on Friday from 9.6%. If you look at our export growth, in fact, we had record export growth for last month. So overall, you know, I think New Zealand has its challenges, and the government's looking to address those. That's why we've had rounds of personal tax cuts. That's why we're looking to liberalise labour laws. That's why we're trying to take the pressure off things with a much more expensive ETS. In the case of Labour, is a cheaper one than our case. So, you know, I think we're doing what we can, but we're always going to be a product of the international environment.
Well, I'm interested, there are going to be some spending decisions in the new year. What kind of things will you be looking at?
Can't detail those today, but as I've indicated last week, you know, we won't be going into election 2011 with a lolly scramble. we recognise the importance of taking the pressure off the Reserve Bank, and the way to do that is make sure that we're fiscally responsible. In fact, in the release of the Crown accounts today, you can see how fiscally responsible we're being, because, you know, government spending was lower than what was predicted by about, I think, $450 million from memory.
But it was hard.
Yeah, well, that's because tax revenue's down, and it's because we had to account for the earthquake. I mean, that factors are partly beyond our control. We are getting that rebalancing, and sometimes when you get that rebalancing, the good news part of the story is you're less reliant on foreign borrowings, and that's good for your external liabilities, but it also means that in the short term our tax revenue's been lower than we anticipated.
Why are you going to review it in the new year? Why not now?
Because we're going to write budget 2011 in the new year.
Does the fact that the Crown accounts are going deeper into the red than anticipated, does that lend a degree of urgency to spending decisions early next year around, for example, welfare and the other things mentioned by the finance ministers?
Well, I think we would all argue we are running a larger deficit than we would naturally be comfortable with, but I think that's been necessary in terms of getting New Zealand through the recession. I think we've tried to take the rough edges off the recession for New Zealanders. I mean, realistically, some of these things are short-term cycles, so GST revenue might be slightly less now, might be slightly more next year. There's certain timing issues there, but it's about the long-term spending track of the government. That's what we're really interested in. So if we can take money as we have in the past out of the baseline, then our long-term implications on the Crown accounts are more important. It's not just the one-off short-term issues.
Just can't be Pansy Wong,
Well, look, I think it's important to understand that the inquiry into Pansy Wong was dictated to by the Speaker, and that's because it was part of Parliamentary Services. In the case of Phil Heatley, that was determined by me, so I referred that to the Auditor General because it was part of Ministerial Services, so it's up to the Speaker. My understanding is that the person that the Speaker chose is highly reputable. I don't know the gentleman in question, but I've got no reason to not believe what he wrote in the report. But I'd say to Phil Goff and to anybody else, you know, if they feel they have information that they want to bring forward and they want investigated, they're free to write to the Auditor General, and she can assess the merits of that. Well, I don't have any information that is not contained in that report. On the basis of the report that we received last week, I'd say no. But as I said, we've got nothing to hide. If someone wants to bring information forward and give it to the Auditor General, they should do so.
If on that basis of that report, you don't have any, it seems there's any rules, does that raise questions about the stuff relative amounts? Because it seems really loose interpretation that you can go to China for 2 months to research, you know, back in history, or
yep,
you know, make dozens of trips in a year. I mean, and it sounds like the spending by Sammy Wong wasn't unusual.
Well, firstly, I think what the report actually says is that with the exception of 1 year, she's actually spent less than the average in terms of the international travel allowance. Secondly, what I think it indicates is the time for the elimination of that entitlement has well and truly come. And that's why we're pleased that the Speaker has accepted the recommendation we made some time ago to get rid of that entitlement.
Given the transparency you've shown over other spending, would you release the spending by
years? Well, again, that's a matter for the Speaker ultimately, because it comes under Parliamentary Services, and I think he's made a determination of what he thinks is appropriate.
Do you think Nature's report would have had more credibility than the one ordered by the Speaker?
Sorry?
Do you think Nature's report on Pansy Wong spending and use of federal entitlement would have had more credibility than the one ordered by the Speaker?
No, because I think in the end, you've got an independent person that's written that report. The Wongs have had to front up and answer questions. I mean, if those answers weren't correct, then that would be a very serious issue for them. And I've got no reason to believe they're not correct.
Phil Goff was back in cabinet within, I think, about 5 weeks. You said Pansy Wong won't be back before the election.
Sorry, Phil Heatley.
Phil Heatley, sorry.
Oh, goodness me. Phil Goff.
We're all having work problems.
That's right, indeed. Well, I was going to say, we're only human.
He was back in the cabinet about 5 weeks after he quit. You said Pansy Wong won't be back again before the election. What's the difference between the two? Is her transgression so much worse than his?
No, a couple of things. Officially, she's asked not to come back into cabinet initially, so that's the first thing. So I think it makes sense for her to spend some time taking the temperature of her electorate, working in her electorate, and continuing to work with the Asian community as she has done for 14 years. I think secondly, and I've made this point to Cabinet, when ministers resign, if they offer their resignation and I accept their resignation, then that is quite a deliberate act, and they shouldn't expect me as a matter of course to reinstate them. It doesn't mean that I won't at some point bring them back. I've made it quite clear I may well bring Pansy Wong back if we get a second term and if she performs well over the next 12 months or so, depending on when the election is. But my main point would be I'm just not going to have people resigning willy-nilly and then bring them back. There's a process for that, and that is if there is an inquiry or there's an issue to be answered that's significant enough, then someone can stand aside, but there's a big difference between standing aside and resigning.
So is that the distinction of
still
here?
Well, no, he resigned, and in the end, the AG's report was such that, you know, I felt that he had made a big mistake and resigned, but I made that clear, and I've made it clear to Cabinet Ministers, if they resign and I accept their resignation, then as a matter of course, I'm just not going to bring them back, even if they're cleared. If they want to go through a situation where they step aside, that's a different scenario. If they resign, then that's a big step.
The Cancun climate change talks are apparently not going well. Are you comfortable that New Zealand's still in the same negotiating block as Japan and the United States, considering that both those countries are opposed to extending Kyoto, and this is creating a lot of hostility from developing countries, many of whom are actually, our trade interests lie with those countries like China much more than they do with
Well, we're sending our two ministers to Cancun, Tim Grosser and Nick Smith. We're going there to genuinely make a contribution to the negotiations in Cancun. I think we can go with a proud record that we've got in place in ETS, and we've started to take action, you know, as we believe is appropriate. And I think, you know, we all acknowledge actually that this is going to be a very difficult process. The expectations out of Cancun are very low. In my view, they might make progress on the funding for developing nations when it comes to adaptation and mitigation, but I'd be surprised if there's a lot more out of Cancun than that.
So aren't we better to align with countries that are more progressive, like the EU, who've got emissions trading system?
Look, I think in the end, you know, the real issue is whether collectively we can get all of the countries to agree to a way forward. It's not really a matter of who we line with on day one. I don't see that as a major issue.
Just going back to the police suit policy.
Yep.
Can we know from those 18 deaths you mentioned this year, how many of those people were fleeing from a crime scene? And do we know how many were actually in their home or their family car?
Yeah, so I don't have that information to hand, but the police minister's office, I'm sure, would. So if you take it up with Judith Collins. In terms of the latter point, though, I raised that issue with her this morning, just in a conversation I had with her, and I understand that, at least anecdotally, the way she gave the information to me is a number are in stolen cars. Because one of the options, of course, available to the government would be to look at the penalties involved for someone that flees from a police pursuit. And of course, you know, there's all sorts of options when it comes to those motor vehicles, but of course if they don't own them, it's another restricting factor.
But we don't know whether they've been engaged in criminal activity apart from stealing the car.
Well, the police minister's office would know, but I don't have that information to hand.
So would one possibly obvious solution be to make the penalty for fleeing a police officer greater than the penalty for stealing a car?
Could be. Or, I mean, often these people owe very large fines. I mean, there's lots of options. But, I mean, we just need to send a very strong message to people that if you flee a police request to stop, that is a very significant action and serious repercussions will result if you fail to stop.
With your point of fact here, Parata, when you made that decision, did you choose the best person promotion to cabinet from within your ranks, or did you look at the sorts of portfolios that person needed to fill? That Pansy Wong had made vacant, and did you weigh that in the mix?
Well, obviously you have to consider the portfolios that the person might go into, and I've made it clear I didn't want a significant reshuffle this year, but I also believe that, you know, in appointing Hekio, I've demonstrated what I said when I first became Prime Minister, and that is I'm going to put together the Cabinet on the basis of a meritocracy, and in my view, she is the most talented person as the next person to come into Cabinet.
There's some noses out of joint, some other names that are perhaps more senior in your ministry already that's got to look forward to pricing.
Well, unquestionably, there will be people that will be disappointed to have not made it into Cabinet, and I understand and appreciate that. And, you know, in the fullness of time and with the good grace of the New Zealand public, I'm sure over time I can accommodate more backbenchers to give them an opportunity to come into Cabinet, but I can't do it in day one. And that's just the reality of having a very talented caucus.
But you've promoted someone over the heads of your whips and senior select committee
chairholders. Yep, and I also brought Stephen Joyce into Cabinet when he'd had no experience as an MP, let alone as a minister. You know, I took a punt and put Paula Bennett in. And then there's been a number of calls I've made, and for the most part I've backed my judgment. In this case, when it comes to Hekia, personally, I think she's extraordinarily talented. And I don't know how far she can go, but I personally think she can go a very long way.
That suggests that there are some longer-serving female members of your caucus that you're not prepared to take a punt on.
No, it just means that I'm, you know, by definition, limited in the number of spots. I mean, there are lots and lots of my backbenchers I'd love to promote, and I think in the fullness of time they'll get an opportunity. But, you know, you've got to appreciate that of the 20 members of the Cabinet, 14 of them were new. I think the Cabinet's actually performed very well. We're a week away from the end of the year. We've been in office just over 2 years. And you know, I think the Cabinet's performed very well. There are always things that people can improve, there's things I can improve. But for the most part, I actually think the team's done a very, very good job.
Did you pay any regard to replacing Pansy Wall with another woman, given that there's not a lot of women in Cabinet?
That wasn't the biggest factor. But obviously, if it hadn't been a woman replacement, then I wouldn't have had a man as the Minister of Women's Affairs. I don't think that would have been appropriate.
Which is the other, does that also solve the problem of you having to take something off someone and give it to anyone who came in who was a man and having to reshuffle a bit more broadly than you would have had to?
Wasn't as overly as complex as you might think. I mean, at the end of the day, there were about four or five candidates I thought were really pressing at the door, and in my view, Hiki was the most talented of them.
Just to go back for a second with this sort of catch-22 nature of these SIS Act changes.
Yep.
In the notes, you say that the public consultation wasn't carried out because the Privacy Commission was going to be consulted.
There were a number of people consulted, yeah, the Privacy Commission.
One of them was the Privacy Commission.
Yeah.
When they suggested that the Act should be strengthened to put in formal principles of proportionality, necessity and reasonableness, these were ignored and said that they belong in the area of a longer-term review, and which you've then declined to do.
Well, declined to do temporarily. So this is an ability to modernise the legislation to best reflect the loopholes as we currently see them, and give greater efficiency and effectiveness to the operation of the Act. But if you spoke to the director of the SIS, I think he would argue with you very strongly that there's a larger piece of work that needs to be done. Now, whether that happens anytime soon, I don't know, but we don't have the legislative headroom to get that done in 2011.
So in the meantime, the Privacy Commission's concerns can be ignored. But they're reporting on this Act, not on some future process.
Well, I am comfortable with the legislation, and I'm very supportive of it, but there will be a process, and you know, she'll be free to make a submission to that select committee.
I'm struggling with the semantics of deferred to do something temporarily. You're either going to do it or you're not.
Well, I can't tell you whether we will do it, because I can tell you we're not going to do it in this parliamentary term. We just simply don't have room. And there were one or two things which were just pressing that we needed to do. And they're primarily around the specific and general provisions. So the law has changed, and the case law has argued very strongly that really, like the police and customs, SIA should be acting with specific provisions. That was important. And there just have been changes in modern-day devices and equipment that means that we should modernise the legislation. But I think there's potentially an argument for a much stronger rewrite of the Act, but I can't get through that process in the next 12 months.
So if we're going to cut corners...
I don't think we are cutting corners. We're actually narrowing the focus of the legislation. We're not cutting corners. We're narrowing the focus of the legislation.
So has there been a whole lot of court cases or rulings or opinions recently that have forced this?
Well, the case law from the Bill of Rights indicates that they'd rather you had specific provisions rather than general provisions.
But has there been something in the recent history that's brought this to a head, or...?
No, but from a practical point of view, as the SIS go about their work, this will make it easier for them.
Is the public going to come out of this process with a clear idea of what the SIS is allowed to do?
Where we think it's in the national interest to do so, yes, but I think it's fair to say that you can see by the fact that we issue 11 to 15 warrants a year on average, we're not expecting to issue a lot more. The benchmark for achieving a warrant being issued is not changing, so it's not getting easier, for instance, for us to issue a warrant. It's just simply a fact that we live in a world that evolves and is a bit different, and we need to modernise to reflect that. But for national security reasons, if I was to detail to you the exact points that I think are potential either deficiencies, it wouldn't just be you that knew that, and I'm not prepared to do that.
If the select committee, it's not actually a select committee, is it? The committee that's going to consider this bill, is it open to the OIA as far as it?
No.
Well, Gough thinks low income New Zealanders should, or they do shoulder too much of the tax burden, do they?
Well, we've cut taxes to mean that, you know, I think it's around about 70-odd% of all New Zealanders pay taxes of no more than 17.5%. And if you think about the tax changes that we've made, we have made significant changes in the time that we've been in office. Last time I looked, you know, Labor spent 9 years in office, and the only time they cut taxes was in literally the dying gasp on the way out when we were putting together our tax plan. So they had 9 years to do that, and they chose not to.
Do the middle income earners shoulder too much of the tax burden?
Well, what I can tell you is if you go and have a look at the structure of personal taxes in New Zealand, there's still an awful lot of personal taxes are paid by a very small group. I don't know off the top of my head have the numbers, but you know, it's you know, at least a quarter to half of the tax base, personal tax base, is paid by a very small group. It's on IRD's website. And in fact, if you earn $50,000 in this country and have two children under the age of 18, you pay zero tax. So actually, you might make the case that higher income earners pay a lot. But middle income earners, they pay a fair bit too. We're doing our best for them. That's why we've been cutting taxes. That's right.
Just one question. We were talking about taking money out of baseline. Can you say a bit more about that?
Oh, just that, yeah, we're looking to try and make savings where we possibly can. We'll detail those next year.